Sanhedrin, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. Here's Jesus, after he has been unjustly treated and insulted, faith in God, trusting that God will take care of justice for him, and trusting himself to him who judges righteously. There's a great story in 1 Samuel where King David gets insulted. I thought it'd be good to just go through the whole story. It's a little longer than these other two examples. Before David became king, he was kind of a mercenary soldier, and he lived near his homeland and spent some time protecting one of the landowners, keeping the sheep and the servants of this landowner named Nabal safe from the raiding tribes that came through the area. And so at sheep shearing time, David sent one of his messengers to Nabal and said, "Hey, we've been protecting your men and your animals. Would you give us a share of the wool?" And Nabal said, basically, "You're a stranger, you're illegitimate, and I'm not going to give you anything." That got David pretty steamed. And it took Nabal's wife, Abigail, coming out with a bunch of food and a very gracious apology that stopped David from massacring every man in Nabal's house that day. But part of Abigail's words to David were, if you had taken vengeance into your own hands, it would be a trouble and a grief to your heart. Don't do it, David. Don't take vengeance into your own hands. Leave it to God. God will make you great. She reminded David, God promised he'll make you great. Don't take vengeance into your own hands. And so David responded to her plea, and he didn't massacre Nabal in his house. Later on, when David was king, his son Absalom tried to usurp him, take over the kingdom. Absalom raised an army and basically chased David out of the capital city, and David had to leave, cross over the Jordan River, go over into Jordan to escape from this coup. And here he encountered another opportunity to respond graciously to a very provoking insult from a man by the name of Shimei. Let me just read it from 2 Samuel 16. "When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul," the previous king that didn't like David, "whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing continually as he came. He threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men that were at his right hand and his left. Thus Shimei said as he cursed, 'Get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you're taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed.' Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, 'Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head.' But the king said, 'What do I do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who should say, why are you doing this?' Then David said to Abishai and all his servants, 'Behold, my son who came out from me and seeks my life now, how much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. Perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of his cursing this day.' So David and his men went on the way, and Shimei kept going along the hillside parallel with him, cursing and throwing stones and dust at him." Can you imagine this guy throwing rocks and dirt down at David and his army, at the king as they're passing by him and shouting insults at him? And David says, he learned a lesson from his experience with Nabal and Abigail, said, you know, don't worry about this guy. It's okay. Absalom then was killed in the ensuing battle that occurred, and his rebellion was ended. So David came back out of hiding, back across the Jordan to come back into Jerusalem and take back over as king. And what do you know, one of the first people to meet him on the other side of the Jordan is an apologetic Shimei. In chapter 19, Shimei, son of Gera, falls down before the king as he is about to cross the Jordan and said to him, "Let not my lord the king consider me guilty, or remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out of Jerusalem so the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down and meet my lord the king." Abishai speaks up again. Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said, "Should not Shimei be put to death for this? Because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" David said, "What do I have to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? Do I not know I'm king over Israel today?" The king said to Shimei, "You will not die." Shimei continued to be unruly over the years, and eventually the police had to kill him for breaking a covenant in a king that reigned after David. But David provides us a good example of suffering insults and leaving vengeance to God. When that Abishai voice says, "You gotta kill him, just get back and kill him, don't let him get away with that," we need to be like David and say, "What do I have to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? What do I have to do with you, Mr. Vengeance? God's going to take care of this. It'll be okay. I'll trust God to do His thing. That's His business." It takes faith. It takes faith to trust that God will take care of an insult. But that is what God calls us to do, is to trust in Him. That's part of trusting in Jesus as our Savior and our Lord. He really will take up your cause. He really will protect your reputation when somebody makes you out to be a jerk or a fool. Somebody says false things about you. Are you willing to exercise faith in God and leave those insults in His hands? Let go of your reputation? Hold your tongue? Not make a snippy comeback? Are you willing to keep your fists at your sides and pray for God to bless them? Notice, what is it? It says what you do after someone slaps you in the right cheek. Does it say turn your back to him so he can't do it again? It says turn toward him. Turn towards him after he has insulted you. That takes some faith in God to keep a relationship open after an offense, rather than closing that thing down so you don't get insulted again, so you don't get hurt anymore. That's the natural thing to do, is to close it down. Don't allow any more opportunities for them to hurt me any worse. But Jesus says, turn towards Him. Turn the other cheek to Him. This is a personal and relational stance to take, not an antagonistic stance. It is a stance of blessing when your face is turned towards them. God promises a reward if we will do good to those who hate us. If we will bless our enemies when they curse us. God promises a rich reward for us if we will do that. Matthew Henry concludes about this verse. "If a man in anger or scorn thus abuse you, turn to him the other cheek. That is, instead of avenging that injury, prepare for another one and bear it patiently. Give not the rude man as good as he brings. Do not challenge him. Do not injure him into an action against him. If it be necessary to the public peace that he be bound to his good behavior, leave that to the magistrate. But for your own part, it will ordinarily be wisest to pass it by and take no further notice of it. There are no bones broken, no great harm done. Forgive and forget. And if proud fools think the worse of you and laugh at you for it, all wise men will value and honor you for it. So there's a response to an insult. Turn the other cheek. Second scenario is response to extortion. Unjust treatment, where you are deprived of your possessions. To the one who wants to be brought wants you to be judged or brought before a judge, or brings a lawsuit against you, wants to take your underwear, your tunic, or your shirt, release to him your outerwear, your cloak, or your coat also. There's the coat sitting on the coat rack there. I wrestled with whether to use the word underwear in a sermon, but I thought it simply communicates in a cross-cultural way this concept of outerwear versus underwear that Jesus was conveying. We wear t-shirts and then an outer shirt or a jacket or something like that. And Jesus' day they had, their clothing, the men's clothing was not so much separated between pants and shirt. It was a full-length undershirt, tunic kind of thing. And then there was an outer full-length robe. But that's the basic idea. And the implication of this scenario that Jesus paints is that the person's trying to rip you off in court. Maybe he is suing you for damages that you didn't incur. You didn't do the damages, but he's trying to pin them on you and make you pay for them anyway. Or maybe you've already done what you've already paid a reasonable. Maybe you really did damage somebody, hurt somebody, and you paid what you thought was a reasonable amount to make it right, but they were still harboring bitterness in their heart, and they are still trying to get more out of you. They haven't forgiven you, and they're wanting you to pay, keep paying. The Jewish code said that if a man pulls another man's ear, or pulls out some of his hair, or spits on someone else, or uncovers a woman's head in the street, he shall be fined 400 zuzim, and as best as I can tell, that'd be about a year's wages. Again, an action that would dishonor someone else was liable to a hefty fine. And so, all out of proportion to any real injury done. You pull some of my hair out, it's no big deal. I don't have to get a year's wages out of you for you doing that to me. But that kind of is a picture, and it helps us understand the litigiousness of the culture in which Jesus was in. Of course, we don't have such a litigious culture now, do we? But yes, of course we do. But one reason why he might be going for your undergarment in court is that the Mosaic law in Exodus 22, I don't know if I have that point written down. Exodus 22, 26 and 27 says that in court you can't take somebody's outer coat. And so the lawyer's sizing up his chances and he's thinking, I could probably get his tunic. The law forbids me from taking his clothes, so I'm going to go after his underwear. So that's kind of a cultural explanation behind this. And so Jesus is saying, give them more than they're asking for. Give them more than they expect to smooth over an offense. Give them more than they expect. Your coat's going to cost more than your t-shirt, but, give it to them. There's a limit, of course, to what you can give, probably. He didn't say if he wants your wife, give him your children also. There are things we can't give, but we can. Most people can afford to just let go of a pair of clothes. That's not gonna do you irreparable harm to give up a pair of clothes. In many cultures, the simple statement, "I like that," will elicit the response, here, do you want to? I don't know, those of you who travel internationally or worked with international students may have seen this. The first time I encountered it, I'd gotten to know a young Jewish man in college, and discovered we had a common interest in music. So I borrowed a jazz tape of Quinn O'Neill from him and listened to it. And so when I returned it to him after listening to it, I said, oh, I really like that tape. And he just gave it back to me and said, well, here, take it. I said, well, I didn't mean that. I just meant I enjoyed it. You know, I'll go buy my phone. He said, no. He said, and the way I was raised, this is how we deal with coveting. You just give it up rather than allowing an opportunity for someone to covet. That's a, you know, wow, what a way to deal with that. Being willing to have a heart willing to give up something just because somebody else said they like it. I remember just a few years ago when we were in Uganda, ran into a similar situation. We had a woman with us on the mission team that had not traveled overseas before and was not very culturally aware of cross-cultural differences. And so we, at one point, we were in a church and she was talking with another woman in the church and said, oh, that is a beautiful dress. It just looks so good on you. And kind of the Ugandan woman kind of got a startled look on her face and said, well, how about I'll give it to you tomorrow? but it's, are we willing to hold our possessions so loosely that we'd be willing to let it go, even if it's stolen from us? I remember when I first got my first car, I worked all summer, the following summer, to earn enough money to buy a nice stereo for it. Installed that thing in there and it sounded great, and I had to do one more car repair before driving from home in Birmingham back to college in Chattanooga. I left the car at the shop. They fixed it. I came back to pick it up and there wasn't a stereo anymore in there. So I talked to the owner, said, what's up? There was a stereo in my car when I turned it in at your shop, and it's not there anymore. I want my stereo back. And the guy said, I didn't take it. I said, well, it was in your lot when the thing was taken. It's your responsibility. And he said, oh, too bad. You've already paid for the repair. And, oh, man, that burned me up. But there's nothing I could do about it. I had to let it go. Doing that takes a very un-American attitude of holding possessions loosely. Material things are such a high value, especially in a culture which believes that the material world is all there is. But instead of considering things to be yours, we have to consider our possessions as ultimately belonging to God. All the things that you own and that you want so much to protect and keep for yourself ultimately are not yours. They are God's. They're given to you by God, and God could take them back at any time. There's a great story that illustrates this by a missionary by his name is Otto Koning. He was a missionary in Papua New Guinea a couple decades ago, and he planted some pineapples in the garden next to his hut there in Papua New Guinea, but he noticed that the natives would go into his garden and steal the pineapples when they got ripe, and so he got all bent out of shape over this. He said, that's stealing. You can't do that. And so I didn't do it, Tuan. They called the white man Tuan. I didn't do it. And he would, you know, set a watchdog out there to try to catch people when they were stealing his pineapples. And it's just, he got so worked up over these people. And, you know, these people didn't know the Lord, and they valued stealing. It was an art form for them, and they had all these different creative ways that they would get into that garden and steal his pineapples, and they seemed to enjoy watching him get upset over the whole thing. It was a big game for them. And he was just getting madder and madder and madder at them. And eventually he went to a conference where he was challenged to just give over things to God. If things that were bugging him, just give them over to God and let God take care of them. So he said, okay, God, I'm going to give you my pineapple patch. I'm not going to be upset about it anymore. I'm going to give it to you. It's not mine anymore. Take care of it, God. And came back from the conference, started living like the garden was God's. You know, he would see the natives go into the garden and say, God, just saying, God, they're coming after your pineapple. And the natives started noticing. They said, Tuan, you've become a Christian. You don't chase us out of the garden with a stick anymore. You're not mad all the time. What happened? And he said, well, it's because they're not my pineapples anymore. And they kind of got worried. Well, whose pineapples are, who are we stealing from now? And he said, well, I gave the pineapples to God. They're his pineapples. So if you steal from them, it's not my deal. And they said, wait a minute, Tuan, we don't want to steal from God. You take them back. It's better to steal from you, Tuan. And he said, no, I gave them to God. I can't take them back now. And he said, you know, since then, he's had pineapples coming out of his ears. He gave his possessions over to God, stopped being anxious about protecting what was his, and trusted God to take care of what God does best, and that is justice. John Gill is another commentator that I've found helpful as I've read Matthew. He said, rather suffer yourself to be stripped naked than engage in a litigious broil. Are you willing to hold your possessions so loosely and consider them as belonging to God that if they were to get unjustly taken away by evil men, you wouldn't lose your joy? Because you know that you have a better and lasting inheritance in heaven? That's what Hebrews 10 says. We have possessions that can't be stolen in heaven. We know him who said, vengeance is mine, I'll repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And it will be terrifying to all who steal from us, who break God's law. But that's not our business. But remember the former days when, after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of suffering, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. For yet in a little while, a very little while, he who is coming will come, and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. This is speaking to believers, Jewish believers, in the early church who were persecuted for their faith. They were able to joyfully accept the seizure of their property because they knew they had a better possession in heaven that they were looking forward to. So the writer of Hebrews encourages their faith and reminds them of the reward. Just as we saw that word reward in Proverbs, in relation to treating your enemies with kindness, because the Lord will reward you. It takes faith, which itself is a gracious gift from God, to respond properly to an insult or to extortion. In the first scenario, of being slapped on the cheek, being insulted, it takes faith to trust that God will preserve and vindicate your honor. In the second scenario, of losing your shirt in court or being stolen from, it takes faith to trust that God will take care of you and bring the evil people to justice. And furthermore, it takes faith to trust that God's rewards are greater in heaven than any possessions that you lose here on earth. If we can trust God in these circumstances, then we can indeed turn towards those who have insulted us. We can indeed graciously release to someone who's taking unfair advantage of us more than they expected, because Jesus has shown His love to us. He has given us more than we deserve. And as a response to His grace shown to us, we can show grace to others. Let us pray for God to give us that grace and that faith to trust Him on a continual basis.